All right, good evening. How's everyone doing? Good to see you all. Genesis stayed home today. A lot of stuff to catch up on in the other house. You know how it's going, and we've been working hard every day. We've been grateful for the help of so many of you, being able to help us financially, but also we've had Brother Bill help all this week with the painting, and it's a lot to do because there were some funky colors, and I wouldn't even start. If you would have seen the house before, the paint job was just, I did painting in college and stuff, and I look at that and I just want to die. You know, it's just one of those things, you know? It's like hearing heresy in the pulpit. You're like, whoa, you want to blow something up. And it's one of those, it's not that level, but I don't know. And so we really thank Brother Bill helping us. And also Brother Heath has been helping, with moving some stuff, and Brother Steve as well. So we're really grateful because we wouldn't be able to do it alone. And, it's like having your extended family, but it's you guys in the sense the church has always been something like that wherever I've traveled. And I know that probably Ali knows what that's like. Travel across the country and you're like, you have no idea who I am, but you say you're a Christian and you know so-and-so and you're like, oh, hey, I love you too. It's great. Come on in. Like, wow. That's fun. It's really exciting. So, all right. What else is that? You know, there are pictures, but you can't see like the close up of the wall. You got to like feel with your hand and just see all the bumps and just years of wallpaper. Anyway, I don't want to get into it. I'm going to took a shower, get rid of all that. No, we're really great. We're really, really grateful. This weekend we're going to be speaking at a chapel in Dallas, not in person. They wanted us to bring us out, but their congregation is still kind of split because it's an Indian congregation, and they tend to be a little more careful. The Indian congregations, a lot of them are doctors and nurses, and they're a little more paranoid, which is okay. So we're doing it on Saturday and Sunday with them. And we're hoping to move in beginning of the month. So if you could be, God be praying for that. Also hoping to rent out the little place next door. We have some different people interested. We're praying for someone that's a Christian. If possible, we'll see what transpires there. Okay, let's jump right in, shall we? Because we have a lot of cool things to talk about, and there is also a lot of gaps we're not talking about. Some of the gaps that we're not talking about, for example, are the history of Islam, which I think is very fascinating. We haven't talked about some other church history figures. We're not going to talk extensively about the mission movement either, which I think is very fascinating. There's a number of little stories like Adoniram Judson. What a name, man. Who names their kid that anyways? Adoniram Judson. Whoa. Anyways, it sounds even worse in Spanish. The guys are like, they named their kid that? And then you have, for example, other great missionaries like Jim Elliot. There's an amazing story of Gladys Elwood. So there's a lot of cool ones. So maybe someday we can get to those. And the other thing is, for example, the history of America, which I'm not going to call myself an expert on it, but I think when we go to history class, we get the politics side of it, or the war and civil war, but we don't get the history in the sense of his story, what God was doing. So in a very small way, we're going to touch on that, and you guys can probably put a lot of pieces together to where it goes. But we're going to talk about George Whitefield and John Wesley. Okay. Now, John Wesley is probably a name more familiar, and I know there's streets named after him. I was just going downtown through Augusta today to get some furniture, and I saw John Wesley, and then it said Gilbert Avenue, and I'm like, how did that happen? Is it maybe split here, or is there a John Wesley Avenue direct? Anybody know that? What I'm talking about? Okay. But just down the road, 2 hours away, Savannah, Georgia, was John Wesley's, that was where he founded the Methodist Church, or the Wesleyan Church, and there's a lot of that. So we're going to talk about two men of history. One of them I admire greatly, the other one I don't. So, and that's going to be repeated next week as well when we talk about two other very important persons, but to the history of the Brethren. So you do not want to miss that one next week. Okay, so George Whitefield is a person we're going to start talking about today. If you guys have your little map or your little notes, you'll know the dates, but I'll tell you anyways. George Whitefield was born 1714, died 1770. Okay, so you can count out the numbers and say he died 6 years before the Declaration of Independence. Okay, so that gives you a little bit of a time frame. The United States hasn't been around that long, to be honest. I think we sometimes we forget. You know, you look at European history and stuff in Italy, and it just goes way back. And then that's, you know, but that's crumbs compared to looking at Egypt. And you're saying, whoa, okay, we're talking thousands of years more. So it's very fascinating. But America has a very special history. When we talk about the history of America, who gets the credit a lot of times? You talk about George Washington, with great merit and great reason and a great man. There's other great men in American history who helped the founding, like Thomas Jefferson. We look a little later on at Abraham Lincoln and the influence of him. What these men have in common, though, in general, especially the origins, is something that in history class they don't want to talk about, and they want to dilute, and sometimes they want to pick at their heirs. But in general, all of the founding fathers of America were either deists or true Christians. Deists meaning they at least believed in a God and an organized world and law and order, and they were also reacting to all the issues in basically the history of the world. You need to understand the United States was the first in so many things. Freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of assembly, then there's religious freedoms, then the ability to express your mind and to write your opinion and to not be bombarded or censored. A lot of these freedoms are being destroyed today, and it's a great frustration to us. There's also funny ones, for example, the freedom to bear arms, which a lot of us think is so weird. I think I've shot a gun a couple times in my life. I wouldn't own one. It's just not a thing for me. But why is it in the Constitution? You say, that's weird. Why is it the Second Amendment? Why is it non-negotiable? Well, the reason was because they fought the British. And they knew what bad government looked like. And the only stop to bad government is the people. So that's why it says, we the people, not I the king. Everything was opposite. Everything was backwards. And if you ask the founding fathers, what were their principles? They were the Bible. It was taking the government style of the law of Moses that God had given. It was taking into consideration the depravity of man. For example, what it says in Genesis, that the desire of the heart of men was inclined towards evil always. I'm not quoting it perfectly, but the verse is so powerful, saying that in the times of Noah, that it was, if we take a balance of where do we sit, people say, oh, we're naturally good, or we're inclined towards good. No, God says inclined towards evil in every thought all the time. If we were let to ourselves, we'd always choose evil. So that's where checks and balances come in. That's where freedoms come in. That's why, as well, another concept that's very important is who's going to stand up for those who have no voice? Have a justice system that can't get paid off. Have government that doesn't have unlimited power. Have small government. Pay your debts. You know that America, the only time we've ever had our country debt-free was in the time of like the third president or something like that. We really failed at that one. But there was an idea of, you know, be accountable. Don't spend more than you have in your wallet. Run it like a small business, not like a government entity. But a lot of great ideas, a lot of great insights, a lot of concepts of don't let anybody be too powerful. Don't let anyone have the authority. And that's why on our very bill, what does it say? In God we trust. I mean, I don't think we realize how radical it was, how mind-boggling it was, and how fantastically well it worked. That's why every other country in the world copied us. I mean, the Constitution didn't get started by the French. I mean, they want to take credit for a lot of things, but they have their little, you know, their revolution and all that stuff, and they want to take credit for founding their democracy and stuff. You're like, no, guys, you were behind, and you guys actually butchered it, to be honest. If you look at the history of France as far as getting rid of their leaders, they basically got rid of all theirs, shot them all up, killed them all, and then they replaced it with, in a sense, other warlords. And you know, Napoleon, you can talk all you want, but he had his little list of bad people too, and he went to town, and then he got taken out, and it just became a big mess. So what made America different? Why did it work here? Why has democracy not worked, for example, in the Middle East? You can talk all you want, but my brother lives there and he says it just doesn't work. It's hard. South America, democracy doesn't work very well. We like to, I've talked to South Americans, I've talked to a lot of political leaders who are my friends in Bolivia. They says, you know what? People just like big government. They like to get handouts. They like to get, in a sense, told what to do. You say, what? Who would want that? But when you've been used to it your whole life, it's hard to have a change of mind. So we live in a very special country, a very different country that's becoming more like everywhere else in the world, quickly. But why did it work? What founded it? What gave this great change? If we look at the time of John Wesley and George Whitefield, in America at that time and in England, there was a lot of religiosity, but there was very little of Christ. So one of the things that most people forget, and they will never connect the dots, especially when you're looking at it at a political or governmental level, is understanding that before the Constitution, there was a time called the Great Awakening. And it was more important than maybe anything else that happened in the history of America, but very few history books will ever even reference it. So let's talk about the Great Awakening. And let's talk about, there was actually two of them, but the big one was in the time of George and John. Two men who were very good friends at the beginning, and then it gets a little dicey, but let's jump right in, okay? So, I'll let you put the pieces together about what happened with America and a lot of different things, and I kind of gave you a tiny little intro. Like I said, I'm not an expert on the history of America or all the leaders and stuff, but I think one of the cool things about history is causality. Why did things happen? What was behind it? Who really influenced it? So we talked about last week. Who's someone that deserves enormous credit for the rise of England to become a superpower from about 1500s till the 1800s? William Tyndale. He does not get any credit. There's no statue to his name. He doesn't get any kind of applause or any kind of famous. But it was him. It was him. I think you can really drive a direct line to him and say this man had a lot more to do than what anybody will ever give him credit for. And by him, that would be okay. Now, George and John were not Americans. They were British. But if I were to be honest, you can connect the dots between George Whitefield and John Wesley to the creation of the first, not the first republic, but maybe we could say the first functioning republic and democracy in the history of humanity that just revolutionized the concept of freedom and what it means and what it costs. And they gave us really what is a golden age to become the United States of America. The country of a bunch of nobodies, pilgrims, people that were struggling for work, convicts, desperate people looking for to make a buck. And they were traveling across the ocean, turned it into a powerhouse, turned it into the first country in the world. Even to this day, you can still make the argument that number one country in the world on basically any standard remains America. How long that's going to last? We don't know, and we're not going to guess, but I don't think we're not going up anymore. So anyways, we're not going to get into that at all. I'm getting myself in trouble. Okay. So let's talk about George Whitefield. Why was he so important? How did he influence America and also Britain, but especially America? Perhaps one of the most famous people in the history of America during his time. But today you will hear very few people talk about George Whitefield. Have any of you guys actually heard of his name before tonight? George Whitefield. Okay, that's good. Now, if I ask any secular audience, how many people would lift their hands, do you think? Probably nobody. Yeah. And when you go across the world, nobody knows who he is. Like, outside of America, very few, and outside of Christians. Now, if I ask about John Wesley, probably more people know about John Wesley, but I would say he had much smaller of an influence. And his influence, so I think, in a sense, was actually far more negative. But we will relate to that a little bit later on. Okay. George Whitefield was an Englishman, and he trained as a young man to become an Anglican minister. Okay. In the Anglican church, which was the official church of England. Now, they had several freedoms. There were other different churches available. But if you really wanted to be in a mainstream Christianity, as it were, and the official church, it was a Church of England. So he studied, became a minister, and he actually made a trip to Georgia in his youth. Okay? And when he became a minister, a lot of times when you were training and, you know, learning and getting your first church to be a minister in, they would send you to the hillbillies across the ocean. And those were the Americans, okay? And there were the colonies and the little, you know, farmhouses and all the difficulties of the New World, which was in this time very difficult place to be. So if I'm not mistaken, he actually did come, I know, to Georgia and I think Savannah, I think, or at least in the nearby area, but he did not come for long. He eventually went back. And during these years, at around his 22nd birthday, A little bit before, he had a radical transformation in his life. He got saved. He genuinely came to know the Lord Jesus Christ in a time, again, where it was very religious, where everybody in England was Christian, but there was very little Christ. It was a facade. It really was. It had become dry, spineless, moralistic Christianity without Christ, which is worth what? Zero. And it's actually negative effect. Okay? And if anything, the church was fighting among itself and fighting for authority and becoming a problem and maybe even heading down the same road as a Roman Catholic church, because again, it was the Church of England. Does that sound like a good idea? No. You don't want to have government involved with church. But, you know, live and learn, and they had not learned. Now, when he gets back to England, and when he's in England, he starts preaching differently because he comes to know the power of the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. Above all things, George Whitfield was an evangelist. Many have said that second only to Charles Spurgeon, the most powerful and impactful preacher in the history of humanity after the time of the apostles was Spurgeon and then Whitfield. So you're talking about one of the single best preachers and most influential preachers in the history of humanity. And people would flock from all over to listen to him. But in his origins, this did not happen. He actually got treated very poorly because he started going. It is said that he went and he studied by himself the Bible at such an extent that when he preached the rest of his life, he would not use a Bible. Can you believe this? He had memorized it back to front. And he would reference, and he memorized the references and everything, and he would reference the text, and he would say it out loud. And there's another reason. He didn't preach in churches. He didn't have a nice little pulpit. He didn't have a nice little roof. He was the first, so many English people thought, the radical open-air preacher, as if it was some novelty. They just forgot about John the Baptist and Jesus and Paul and Peter. But anyways, it was a novelty, and it was very bad. But when he started, he was a minister, and he would get up there and he would preach with fire and with passion. I don't know if you know many British people, but my experience with British people, half of my family coming from the Scottish and English and heritage, so I don't want to be too mean. But have you ever heard them tell jokes? You know, it's kind of like super dry. And then there's the joke about the British person laughing Sunday morning because he got the joke you told him on Friday. You know, there's a lot of different things. They are very, stereotypically, they're more of a traditional, cut and dry culture, dry humor, very traditional, I think is the word, even to this day. And there's a lot of great things, but their church really reflected their culture, especially in this time. So if you stood up and you started yelling from the pulpit, you started pounding your fist, you started, pointing at people. I remember when I was preaching one of my first messages at Emmaus, I was preaching one time, and I was a student still, and I got to preach one time, and I used the word you in the message. I said you, and one of the old professors came, and he was British, and he came up and says, "Brother, never use the word you, just say we, you know, make everybody feel included." And I thought about it, and I went and looked in the Bible, and I came up with all the words you, like all over the place, and pointing fingers, and Jesus, and John the Baptist. I said, wow, they wouldn't have been very welcome. I mean, these guys were, you know, John the Baptist, you know, there is a axe at the root of the tree if you don't repent. I mean, it's ugly, it's bad. And I said, okay, I'm so sorry. I was very young, and I didn't know any better, but if he would have told me that today, he would have gotten a very different answer. But probably better it didn't happen. Later. He was accused, George Whitfield, of acting, of exaggerating, of being over the top, of being, in a little bit of a way, a charismatic, but as if it was something heretical, as if it was something dangerous, as if it was something evil. Now, I agree. There's preachers who just, you know, blow the top off and they're yelling, they're acting, and it's kind of for show, and there's certain denominations that kind of push that style. But what if it's for real? What if that's who he was? What if that desperation was the soul of an evangelist saying, I don't want anybody to die without knowing Jesus? He was accused as he started getting more and more popular because people would flock to listen to him. And they started going at him and going at him and going at him. And finally, one day, he responded saying, I will not be a velvet-tongued preacher. Very nice quote, huh? He says, I will not be a velvet-tongued preacher. God has called me to do this. I'm worried about people that are dying and going to hell every single day, thinking that everything is fine. Now, if you guys know, just a little piece, so you guys can do some your own research if you want. There's a certain person called Jonathan Edwards, born the same time period, the same thing happening in New England, just the same time. And his most famous message, sinners in the hands of an angry God. Now, the difference between Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield is that by people's estimation, George Whitefield was like the superstar of preaching, and Jonathan Edwards was the put-you-to-sleep of preachers. And you won't see that a lot, you won't hear that a lot, but he was brilliant. But a lot of people said, how did he get so successful and influence so many people, especially with that message being so boring? The answer is this. Because God changes hearts, not people. You can be the greatest preacher in the world and had no influence. And God used in the same time a very cut and dry theologian like Jonathan Edwards and someone that was all spunk and charisma like George Whitefield, and they worked together. So another story, but they were both influenced in the Great Awakening at the same time in England and in New England. And you said, is that coincidence? No. Obviously, it was the Spirit of the Lord working. And later they put it together, and it was Jonathan Edwards who put it together and says, God's doing something. Let's do it ourselves too. But in England, it happened with George Whitefield being kicked out of the English church. He lost his license to preach and everything, and he was basically jobless at a very young age, at about 22 years old. He had just started, and he got himself in so much trouble for being a loudmouth, for yelling, for acting, for jumping. And this was just the beginning. He was going to get way worse. He was going to scare people to death, the religious people, like the leaders, because they were, you got to preach this way, don't raise your voice, you have to be very calm. And it was all about tradition. He one time gave an example to them, and he said, if you were walking down the street and you saw your house on fire and you knew that your children were in that house, what would you do? What would you say? You say, oh, hey, neighbor, can you help me out? It looks like my kids are maybe burning alive. Could you kind of help me out? You know, we need a little bit of help. What would you do? You'd be screaming bloody murder. Would you be acting? No. What you don't realize, he told the elite theologians of his time, is that there are people dying and going to hell every single day, and you guys are sleeping. And it was so shocking to them. But instead of listening, they expulsed him. They threw him out. It reminds me a lot of the Pharisees' treatment of Jesus, to be really honest with you. But he did not give up. He headed to the hills of Scotland. And what transpired would change, really, in a sense, the church of his time forever. Now, we're going to leave that story for a little bit, and we're going to talk about the other person in the story called John Wesley. Okay, they had a lot in common, especially this time, so they have similar path. But we need to back up a little bit and go to John Wesley. He's a little bit older, about 11 years older, born in 1703, and also lives longer until 1791. He would have lived right through the War of Independence and all of that. So I've actually never read anything about him on that, but that would be kind of fascinating to know his opinion on that. But anyways, another story for another day. So John Wesley was one of 19 brothers and sisters. One of his most famous brothers was Charles Wesley, the famous hymn writer. We have way too many hymns by him. And if you think you know all the hymns by him, you don't know that we only have about like 5% of his hymns actually in the hymn book. The rest of them, there's thousands of hymns. If I'm not mistaken, it's 3,000 hymns he wrote. I mean, we have, what, 500 in our hymn book? He wrote 3,000. It's just mind-blowing. Anyways, and some of them are very, very beautiful and very special. John Wesley also wrote a few hymns, by the way. I couldn't figure out how to translate them, to be really honest with you. So someone can help me later, but there's a few hymns by John Wesley, too. Okay, so of his 17 brothers and sisters, he was just one. And he was very, one of the very fascinating things is his mother. His mother was called Susanna. Now, Susanna, imagine having to raise 19 kids and, you know, do it on a tight budget. And she also made sure to spend time with each one of them every single day. She had a little piece of time with every single child, helping them, encouraging them, teaching them. And then she did Bible studies. I think she taught from home. But again, on a very tight budget, working very hard. You know, there was no microwave and that kind of thing either. So she was a very dedicated woman. John Wesley founded what's called the Methodists. That word Methodist comes from the word method or methodology, meaning doing the same thing the same way every single time. Where did he learn that from? From his mom. So in a good sense, he learned discipline very young. And he also knew that at a very young age, he had to help provide for the family. So at a very young age, he actually started working. He worked at a textile mill, what do you call it? Okay. Okay. I'm not sure but one of these big, huge buildings that had hundreds of workers all crammed in there. And he was young and he was making probably very small salary and everything, very dangerous conditions, no workers' compensation, you know, what we have nowadays, none of that. And the thing caught on fire and the whole structure was wooden. Can you imagine? Everybody stuffed in there. Of everybody in that building, the only one to come out alive was John Wesley. And when he came out, he realized can you imagine the traumatic experience that would be? And he says, obviously God has a reason why he saved me and my life is no longer my own. And that burned in his mind. So he decided to change his career path, whatever it had been. And he said, I'm going to be a minister in the Anglican Church because that's the highest goal he could think of as far as serving the Lord. So he goes to school and guess who is his friend at Bible college or whatever you would call it, theological school. George Whitefield. And who else? Charles Wesley. And then there's a couple other. And in college, they start a group they call the Holy Group. And this little Holy Group is led by the oldest of them, which is John Wesley. And John Wesley, being very methodic, said, God has given us a purpose and we need to use every second of every day and not misuse any of it or else the Lord is going to be upset. So his idea was that we have to stop sinning. He actually believed you could stop sinning. We have to use every second of every day to the greatest extent. So he had these great ambitions and it sounded very nice. And all these people were trying very hard. But here's something really funny. Years later, each one of them admitted that they were not saved during the time when they were practicing with the Holy Group. I think it says something very important to us too today. Religiosity does not equal relationship with God. And in this country, it was full at that time of religiosity, but no relationship with God. It was very much, you knew the right answers. When I was a kid, I've told you guys my testimony before. I knew all the answers. I sang the loudest. I was part of Awana. I was part of all the groups. I knew all the answers. I was the preacher's kid, you know, traveled all around. You know, and did everything with my dad, and I even evangelized, and I'd been preaching for a while when I was I don't know, the Lord will tell me someday, but I think I didn't get saved until I was 19. I was playing at religion, and it's very common for kids who are born into a Christian family. You just don't know, why do I believe? What is, you know, so I think there's a great warning here that sometimes I've had, at schools or parents or people say, man, these people aren't doing the right thing. We need to put more rules down. My kid isn't listening. I need to put more rules down. And I says, you know, if you put a lot of rules down, you're going to get one of two responses. Either the kid is going to rebel openly and is just going to throw it in your face and make a disaster of everything, or they're going to obey you when you're looking, and then they're secretly going to break all your rules and they're going to be hypocrites. If there is no desire in the heart to do the right thing, then rules are pointless. That's the big problem with rules. That's why the law of Moses, it was perfect. What was the problem? The people weren't perfect. So it bothered them. So that's why Paul says in Romans chapter 7, the law actually made me want to sin more. And then because I knew how many more sins there were available, I was just more guilty. So the law gave me diddly squat in good. What it gave me was a guilty conscience and a sinfulness. And what was the point of the law? To drive you to Christ. That was the point. And the Pharisees missed it totally. Whoop, right over their head. Another story for another day. This holy group was a failure completely. One of the sad things is that George Whitefield didn't really lose that idea, though, about, you know, losing your salvation, being sinless, this idea of method is the best over everything. You couldn't break that. It wasn't bad, the idea of having methods and organization. But if there is no relationship, it is religiosity, which is way more dangerous, I think, than even atheists. Atheism is less dangerous than just false religiosity. And that's why the Bible warns us over and over again of false teachers, and then it talks about the Pharisees who had all the right answers, but lived lives that were very different to the Word of God in their hearts. Now, John Wesley, when he graduates, becomes a minister, and he gets sent to where? To Georgia! Looks like it was a place to send everybody. So he gets sent down to Georgia. I forgot to tell you, right before he gets sent down to Georgia, he did actually have a job in London, and he was a minister, he was growing, but he had a very big problem with lust, and he wanted to get married, but, you know, the girls were too attractive, and he couldn't focus on a ministry, and he was really, you know, discouraged by the whole thing. So he says, I'm gonna leave all this, it's a big problem, all the women in England are too pretty, I'm gonna go to America where all the ugly women are at. He literally thought that. So he comes over to Georgia, and guess what the first thing that happens to him? He falls in love with a lady in his congregation. So obviously that did not hold water, his argument. And when he comes to the chapel, to the church where he was the minister here in Savannah, Georgia, an Anglican church, he sees this girl and he says, he eventually comes and says, I want to marry you. She says, oh, I'm sorry, I'm already engaged to so-and-so. And he just loses it. He gets so mad. I'm not sure what the right word is in the Anglican church, but it basically comes down to excommunication. He excommunicates the girl and her fiancé because he wanted to marry her and he was so upset he just tossed him out of the church. I mean, how irresponsible is this, right? And he says, I'm done with America. The women are too pretty here. I'm going to go and live in a cave somewhere. So he takes the boat back to England. But on the way, there is a terrible, terrible sea storm. And the storm is so terrible that the mariners, you call them mariners, right? Are throwing everything overboard and crying for their life. And everybody is just panicking. It is going to sink. It's going to go down. And in a group, there's a group in a corner there on deck that are all holding each other and huddled together. And they're praying and they're singing. And he sees these people and he says, wait a minute. Because he knew these group was a group called the Moravians, who were this weird little group of like ancient Christian group that came out of Europe, like whatever, you know, you guys aren't a big church, you're not official. And he was the Anglican minister. And he's, pardon the expression, he's peeing his pants. And these guys are in a corner, huddled, praying and singing. He says, they have something I don't. I missed the boat. I'm about to die and I'm afraid of death. And these people are obviously have something I don't. So in the middle of the storm, he goes over and he has some conversation. He says, I need what you have. And some way or another, in the process of this storm, he gives his life to Christ. And he is saved. And he gets back to England safely. The storm assuages, and he's saved again. Second time in his life, he's saved from a desperate situation. He makes it back, and all of a sudden, now in the pulpit, guess how he's preaching? Just like George Whitefield. He is stamping and yelling and excited and talking about the gospel, and these old men are sitting there saying, hey, sonny, you know, drop the voice. Don't get excited. Don't exaggerate. Don't point any finger. Don't be doing this. And, you know, the Anglican church especially, you had to preach from a certain location. You need to use a certain type of wording. You need to be very, very careful. I often explain the Anglican church, especially in that era, as Protestant theology with Catholic look. It looked and felt like a Catholic church, but the messages and the way of preaching was very much biblical. So that was the problem that people had. So he comes in and he's making an absolute wreck. You're supposed to be a priest and, you know, real calm and serene, inspire peace and comfort so you can fall asleep. You know, I'm kidding. But it wasn't working for them. So they kick him out. And he's beside himself. He says, what is wrong with these people? Can't they see we're dying? We're just in miserable you know, religiosity is terrible. And he hears from his good old friend up north, and George Whitfield says, hey, I heard you had a little bit of a problem. Tell me about it. I've been there too. Why don't you take a little trip up to Scotland, take a look at what's happening, maybe you'll get some idea. So George Whitfield invites him up, and John Wesley makes the trek up north, and outside of a mine, standing on top of a hill, is George Whitfield one afternoon with Jonathan. What are we doing here? He said, just wait. Sun is going down, and out of the mine starts to come the miners. And they were known for being, you know, the worst of the worst. Just, you know, alcoholics and sleeping around with prostitutes and all the grossest stuff. The very scum of society were the miners. For whatever reason, especially in this location. And they were walking out. And John Wesley pictures it. He says they were walking out with these faces that were black with soot from working in the coal mines. Can you imagine how horrible that job would have been? And the life expectancy down to take. It was just horrible. And they were walking out. And George starts talking to them from up there. Just so you know, there was a famous scientist called Benjamin Franklin, by the way, who later on in life becomes such a huge fan of George Whitfield. He thought he was the best thing since sliced bread. And he calculated how far his voice could reach. No microphone, no megaphone, no funny business. Over 1 mile. Can you imagine? God gave him that. And he's like the opera singer turned preacher. I mean, he had buckets for lungs. Just incredible. Over 1 mile is what Benjamin Franklin estimates his voice could be heard distinctly. Now, up from the hill, he's preaching down at them, and George and John says something incredible happened. During the message, as George is preaching, the black faces start to get streams of white. And these hardened men are crying like children and giving their lives to Christ. And it broke all the stereotypes. You're open air preaching. Is this available? Can you do this? Isn't this some kind of a law you're breaking? And he's like, I don't have to be the church to preach. I don't have to be recognized as a minister. I love Jesus and I want him to know. Stop me if you can. That was his message, basically, to the hierarchy. And he just started going. And then John and George started to go around England and doing open-air preaching. People were coming out in humongous mass. Others were starting to join them. They were the two heads, in a sense, of this movement. But others were joining. In America, they were doing the same with Jonathan Edwards. And then George and John said, hey, what about America? We've heard of some cool things going. So they take a boat across. And then they split up and they start preaching north and south, and they have every single day on a horse or in a carriage and stopping at a town, preaching 8 hours, you know, street preaching in the marketplace. They find a table, they stand up on it, just crazy out of their mind evangelists, especially George Whitfield. People are giving their lives to Christ in droves. Say one time, 50,000 people came to hear George Whitfield at one time. And in that time, that was a number you'd never heard of being congregated at the same time. That was as big as maybe New York City in that time. And the amount of people that would walk for even days just to hear. It is estimated that 80% of Americans during this time heard George Whitfield preach at least once. He was the most influential man in America this time, without a radio, without a telephone, without a microphone. And people loved him. Even people who never gave their life to Christ, like Benjamin Franklin, couldn't get enough of him. They're like, I want to go listen. Really? You have nothing better to do on your Friday night? You're really going to go and listen to a street preacher? We don't even believe the stuff he's saying. Oh, he's just so interesting. And he told the greatest stories. And he was so interesting and truly charismatic because it was real to him. He wasn't selling snake oil. This was the most important thing to him. So George Whitfield, here's a few numbers on him. For the next 30 years, he would preach an estimated 1,000 times per year. Do the math. He's preaching 3 times a day. It would take him, it was a full-time job of 40 to 60 hours between preaching and traveling to the next town and sleeping in a different bed and eating out of a different plate every single night. Now, he was also the most important person in unifying America, because those people who gave their life to Christ, it wasn't for show. It was like Billy Graham, but on steroids. People were really giving their life to Christ. Churches were being revolutionized. Everybody from all walks of life were coming to Christ, filling churches, and they were excited about learning about the Word of God. And it no longer became about denomination or about division. It became about having a personal relationship with the Lord. It was fabulous. That's why it's called the Great Awakening. So when you talk about, you know, people say, we need an awakening. Yeah, that sounds great. We really love that to happen. But when an awakening comes, you'll know. And that's not happening right now. And we'd love it. We're praying for it. And that's, there's nothing wrong with that, to be excited about the possibility. But this was an amazing movement of the Spirit of the Lord. It wasn't just because they were such great preachers. Charles Spurgeon didn't have this kind of reaction. They did. And many others who sprang up across America and Europe, especially England. Now, I got to tell you a few bad things. Man, can't believe it. Running out of time again. Whitfield felt pressure to be married. He was the most famous man on the planet. He was Michael Jordan walking. Okay? He was it. Every girl in town wanted to marry him. And he felt the necessity to get married. Because, I don't know, he just felt that it was right. I think he should have stayed single. He wasn't actually that excited about the idea. He felt very pressured into doing it. And eventually he picks out a girl who's from a good family and stuff in London. I think it was London. And he writes a letter to the dad. And the letter to this one girl that he's interested in says, dear so-and-so, I would like to marry your daughter, but do not worry, he says. I am not physically attracted to her. There's nothing, I'm not going crazy over her. I just feel this is a step from the Lord and I felt called from him, but he kind of had this caveat of, don't worry, I'm not in love or kind of crazy or, he tried to spiritualize it, okay? And the father responds back, take a hike. I don't care. And my dad used to say, if you can't kiss her, you can't marry her. Be done with it. I mean, if you're not crazy about her, then what are you getting married for? So he writes to another father later on, same kind of attitude, and the guy's like, oh, of course, you can have my daughter. Yeah, it's great. They get married. George Whitfield had the idea that you could not love anybody but Jesus. Therefore, he never told his wife he loved her. Never. He believed it was at odds. And it's kind of like you can, the way you love God is very different from how you love pizza or you love someone else. It's another stratosphere, but it doesn't change the fact that we are called in Scripture. If you're married, that becomes your number two responsibility in the universe after God, and nothing else takes its place, period. And he missed it. He never told her he loved her. One time there was a person who came and visited her because George Whitfield would spend about it is estimated that he would spend a certain amount of time with her, then he'd travel. Because she would not travel with him. Because it was, he said, I want you to settle down, you know, maybe let's form a church, let's do something here. And he would travel like crazy. One time it was 7 years between their meetings. 7 years. And someone came and said, what does it feel like to be the wife of George Whitfield? And she responded, I think, very wisely. She said, you tell me, you know I'm better than I do. Ouch. That's terrible. So that's very, very sad. But if you want to top it, let's talk about John Wesley real quick. John Wesley, as we know, formed eventually the Anglican Church and many other things. One of the challenges with him is that he started to split with George Whitfield. George Whitfield was a Calvinist. John Wesley was an Arminian, but he was a militant Arminian. He actually wrote a newspaper called The Arminian, where he would hammer George Whitfield all the time and try to make him look bad and say he was a heretic, and it started to divide them. George Whitfield never answered back. He was never harsh on him. He was always trying to remedy the relationship. But what many people think is that John Wesley felt intimidated by how famous of a preacher George was, and he was going to kind of get in the shadow. So he didn't like being the second best. And he was older as well. So it was very hard for him to have his friend who, you know, was in front. One time there was a little conversation after a meeting, and some young people came and tried to get, you know, the headline story. And it said, Mr. George, Mr. Whitfield, do you think we will see Mr. Wesley in heaven? And the idea was, this guy is, you know, heretic, off his rock. They're causing all the division. He's writing against you. Who would do that? And it is said that George Whitfield responded. I actually have seen this flipped on the internet. Not true. This is not something that George Whitfield definitely said, not John Wesley. It goes against everything written about him. George Whitfield responded. He says, we will not. And they were just like ready to get the latest news story, right? And he says, you know why? Because he's going to be so close to the throne of God and we will be so far back, we won't see him. And all of a sudden they said, whoa. How about that answer? He would not stir the pot. That relationship was never restored. And it was a trend. It was a trend with John. John eventually felt pressured to get married too. Probably another man who could have stayed single. Well, in his case, I'm not quite sure. But what happened is that he did get married. And he told his wife, honeymoon is the next town, preaching tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Like, what? And she did it for a month. She handled it for a month. Horseback riding, spending the night in a tent, no honeymoon, no nothing, and just from here to there to there to there to there. And he was basically hiring a maid service. That's what she felt like. And after a month, she says, I'm done. We have the money. We're okay. Why don't you buy me a house? And why don't we settle down and we can start a church? And you can do your ministry and stuff, but do it, you know, have family, have kids. That's what the Bible says. And he says, no, the Lord has called me to this, but well, you can't do it with me. I am staying home. And he was very strong and she was very strong. So she stayed home and he started going around the world and he would see her every once in a while. But he would send her letters every single day. She would receive letters from him. Isn't that sweet? And the letters were a list of things she had to do in the house. The Methodist himself telling his wife how to be a good wife. And I'm not kidding you. Now, as his travel started to go, he would come back, but he didn't like to spend much time at home, because they're just, every time he came home, it was to fight. I've actually heard of people who say that they like their job that takes them away because they see their wife less, because every time they see their wife, they just fight. But why does that happen? Because you're not fixing the problems. There was one of the things that Genesis and I decided when we first, even before we got married, that we wouldn't go to bed angry. And it's just something I saw from my dad and I picked it up and man, a lot of times I regret it. I'm like, why did we make this promise? What a dumb idea. I mean, I've stayed up. I'm not kidding you. You think I'm so easy to get along with. I'm hard-headed and I'm dumb. And the later it gets, I get more frustrated and it just gets worse. I've stayed up till 4 a.m. trying to fix the thing. Like, I'm like, boy, what are we doing? This is so dumb. You know, and I got to wake up in the morning and do this. And we both looked at each other and said, we made a promise and we're going to fix this. Because the joke I always say is I want to wake up in the morning and say, good morning, sweetheart, not good morning, ogre from hell. You know, and I learned a long time ago from other relationships with just friends that if you don't fix something on day one, day two, it just doesn't go away. And the longer you wait, it is gangrene. It's cancer. It sprouts wings. It gets uglier. And then when you actually want to fix something, you have 25 things that have been adding up and adding up and adding up. And you're going to pay the count now. Like, so you do one at a time. But I'm only 3 years in. I have a lot to learn. And you can ask her how hard it's probably been dealing with me because, you know, I'm a big moron. But she's been very kind and patient. And I've learned a lot. But that's something we just decided. Like, this comes first. I said, I can't even do ministry with a straight face to say, if I'm failing at home, everything is a failure. You know, the day I die, I hope on my gravestone, if I ever get one, I hope I get raptured. But like I had a gravestone, I hope it says something about being a good father, and if I get to be a father, and a good husband. The rest of the stuff doesn't matter. When you die, they're not going to ask you how many messages you preached, or how many cars you own, or how many houses you had. They're going to ask about what kind of a person you were. And I've often thought about going to my own funeral and said, if I ever get to my own funeral, what would they say about me? And of the things they say, how much of it is actually true? Could you go to these funerals like, oh, this guy was a great dad and this and that and the other. And then I never remember when I was a kid, I was sitting there like, Mom, who was this guy? He's like, he was a drunk. I'm like, whoops. You know, they say the nice things, but is it true? So talking about being a husband, John was up there with the worst. Let me just put this out for you. I forgot a little piece. Wesley preached 40,000 sermons in his lifetime. He traveled an equivalent of 250,000 miles, what a car drives in 10 years, on horseback and ship. He published 400 books, and he wrote many hymns. He founded the Methodist Church. He inspired millions. He had so many people who came to Christ. But does that matter? And do I consider him a hero with what you're about to hear next as the last piece? He and his wife had a lot of problems. They did not fix the problems. He liked to be away from home. And when they got together, it was explosions because they both had a strong temperament and nobody wanted to fix the problem. So it just festered and festered, but they never talked about it. He had no confidence. He had no help because he was at the top of the pig pile and he was not accountable to anybody. And at the end, what happens is his wife starts receiving his mail and he always told her, you do not touch my mail. It will stay there. It will collect. And when I get home, I will look at it and I'll respond. And it was fan mail. People were crazy about it. But she started realizing she wasn't any dumb lady. The same names kept coming up for certain ladies that kept writing him and writing him and writing him. And she started to get curious. And so she started looking at his mail from these specific women who were sending once and again letters to him. Now, I don't want to tell this because people are like, oh my gosh, you can't say this. But it's true. This is really historic. From what we understand, this really happened. She basically found out he was having multiple affairs across his ministry in different parts of the world. And these women kept writing. And so one day he gets back and she confronts him about it. He says, what is this? And it is such a terrible... Now, the fights were always terrible. And I'll just give you one example. One time a friend of theirs walks in on them when they're having a tremendous fight. And just to show that it kind of went both ways, because sometimes all the blame needs to go just on the man, like that's not exactly always true either. She was dragging him by his hair like a mop across the floor when the friend walks in. I'm not kidding you. So this was a big, powerful woman too. I mean, she was very angry. And so it takes two to tango, like Mr. Louis Armstrong used to say, right? This was a problem on both ends and nobody was willing to fix it. And then this time though, she had actually left on several occasions back to her home and then they'd kind of figured it out and she'd come back. But this time she confronted him. He got very angry. He actually said some really horrible, horrible things to her. And she left. She went back to her dad's house. And I don't have the number here. I think it's actually in the book. It was a couple decades later, if I'm not mistaken, when he finally went back to look for her. I want to finish with the story. But they say that he went to her house and he knocked on the door. Dad answered, very old by now. And he says, I'm looking for my wife and I want to reconcile and I know I've messed up and stuff. And he says, okay. She's out back. Very cold response. He's like, okay, you know, I'm not welcome here where it is really bad, but it's been like 20 years, give or take. I can't remember exact number. He goes out back. There's nothing there. There's just, you know, there's the patio and the hay and there's a little cemetery and there's the chickens. And he goes out front again. He says, sir, I don't see her anywhere. Where is she? Third cross. She was dead. He never reconciled with Whitfield. He never reconciled with his wife. And one of the sad things is that the Methodist Church, although I think they have a lot of good things, especially in their original history, is that they don't want to recognize the downfalls. I think a lot of people do that, for example, today with Calvin, John Calvin. Phenomenal man. They don't talk about his limitations. Luther. The Lutheran Church makes him into some kind of a miracle worker. Very human. And he said, people want to turn me into a fixed star. I am a streaking star. How do you call that? I am a shooting star. That's how he referred to himself. Francis of Assisi, when they came to him and said, they're going to canonize you when you die, they told Francis of Assisi. He says, what? I can yet have children. That was a very funny response, but saying, like, I can still make a big mess of my life. What are you guys talking about? Like, I'm no perfect man. So, very far from the reality, sometimes we can heroize without seeing the reality that they had clay feet. So I asked myself, is George Whitefield the hero to me? And I says, I admire a lot of things. I think he royally messed up as a husband. He wasn't evil to her. He wasn't mean to her. But he did not invest nearly enough time into it. He did not realize the priority of it. When the Bible tells us in Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Do you think John Wesley or George Whitefield followed this? None of us do. But that's a big zero right there. It's a big zero. Like Christ loved the church. You know, I could go in and talk a little bit and give you some stories, but there's a lot of stories of men who've had great success in ministry, but they're failures at home. I actually think there's a psychological drive behind it. If you were a failure at home, you want to succeed somewhere else. And one of the things that God tells you is if you don't succeed at home, all your other success will be worthless. That's why it says in the listing of categories for an elder, what does it actually talk about? Your family life. Like, what does that have to do with my work description? I mean, if I go and work at the power plant, they're not asking me how I treat my wife. Well, God does ask that. Because he's like, I don't want you to be a hypocrite. You know, I don't want you to say, oh yeah, you know, I'm going to give you some marriage advice and some kid advice and some this advice and all this kind of advice. And you're living something else. I mean, we're all sinners. We all have clay feet. But one of the things my dad taught me is God comes first. And if you're married, then comes your wife. Then come your kids. Those aren't one. Then comes your kid. Because the kids, like the arrows, you know, you put an arrow and you shoot it. But your wife is your wife until death do you part. And then comes ministry. And a lot of people think that ministry is supposed to, like, God is ministry. Like, that's the same thing. If I come to church, that's God right there. No, God is, what does God think of you? What relationship do you have with him? It has nothing to do with how many hours of ministry, how many times you preach, how much you know about scripture. It's, do you love God? And that's for me too. And then comes family, which is widely misunderstood nowadays as something kind of a bother. And children, I'd rather have a dog, you know? Like, really? It's okay. No, dogs are nice, but raising children, investing in them, and they're like, oh, they're so expensive. Oh, it's so time. Oh, my kid is a rebellious. Well, maybe because you don't talk to them. Maybe because you've given up trying. And I'm not one to give any advice because I've never had any kids. So shoot me later and tell me about it. But Lord, help me to give my best shot. Because I need to realize if I get that wrong, I will be a hypocrite. If I stand up and give a message, it doesn't matter how many people I preach to or wherever I go. If I'm a bad father, if I get to be one, if I'm a bad husband, then my life will be a failure. Because that's what God called me to do. You know? The Apostle Paul, just like Brother Ted, skirted it. Oh, I'm single, so your priority is the Lord. And that is a wonderful calling. And it's a specific calling. But when you're married, God says, okay, here's your new priority. You better get it right. And that's a big, big, big ask. And I think I owe a lot to my dad, who a lot of times I think gave up a lot of ministry opportunities and different things because he wanted to include us as kids. He wanted to bring us along and he wanted my mom to be a part of it. I've actually, one thing I learned is, for example, they've invited me to preach sometimes and I tell them I come with my wife. Oh, we can't budget that. It's too expensive, especially in South America. And I said, if my wife doesn't come, I don't come. And I've had canceled events just because they don't want to pay for the wife. Or I'd have to pay for her myself. And I says, you don't realize how important this is and the kind of precedent you're setting. If you can't invite the husband and wife, don't invite anybody. But I, you know, something I learned and a lot of lessons. So I'm so sorry. We did go over, but these two men, I think their stories are really powerful. In the danger of thinking that, especially in American society, what you do is not who you are. What you accomplish is not what you are always going to be remembered by. What's most important is who God thinks we are as women, as men, as fathers, as children, as everything we are and how we do that before God. Everything else doesn't matter. You can get all the titles here and God will say, cheap. If he looks and says, wow, you know, with your limitations, I'm proud of you. You made it. That's what it's about. God's opinion of us. So sorry again for going over, but it is a very important topic for me and very close to my heart. And it's something I've always needed to always remind myself of every day. When I got married, I didn't realize how big of a challenge it was going to be. The hardest thing I ever had to do was be a husband. And I haven't even been a father yet, so don't even ask me yet. And it's hard. And then I'm going to have kids, and like it's going to start all over again. And I says, but you know what? I've always said the best things in life are the things that are the hardest to accomplish. The things you're proudest of are the things you work hardest at, right? So I want to encourage anybody who's married in here. I'm just a young buck. I don't know anything, but I will say I've seen a lot of great marriages and I've seen them from afar. And I always say, man, I want to get there one day. So I encourage you to, if you're a husband or a wife, love your partner to death and just focus on it and work on it. And if you've not, and if you've been called to something else, God hasn't forgotten about you. And there's something else to pour everything you have into as well. And our priority for everybody's God. Period. For God is the priority of everything. And I've often thought, how do I give God the glory in a marriage? Well, if I'm a good husband, then what am I actually doing? I'm actually pleasing my Father in heaven. So it's all one. And if you do anything to the glory of God, you're pleasing, you're, if you do it right, everything, your work, your family, everything. And if you do that right, what is it doing? It's pointing all the way back up to the Lord and giving him glory. So if the priority is God, then everything we do points to that. Being a student, being a son, being a father, being a grandparent, anything we are. So let's close in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for these hard stories of George and John. And in spite of their record-setting numbers in many ways, I look at their family life, which maybe they were very ashamed of, but yet, you've allowed us to know these things today about them, and we wonder, and I wonder, what you think of them, and what you think of us. We're just so small and insignificant, but help us, Father, with your Holy Spirit, to realize the priorities in life, to really focus on that, to really dig deep and invest in the things that are really important for eternity, and not just for showing off, not just for being seen in public, the things that many people don't see. When you're fighting for it, really matters, Father. Help us in that. In Jesus' name, amen.